This is the Game Act Hotline special interview edition with John Williamson, president of Zombie Incorporated.
Guess what? I got a fever. And the only prescription is more
Game Addict Hotline.
And welcome to the Game Addict Hotline. Please turn your video games down and this podcast up. We are your latest source for video game news, video game releases, and today, a video game interview. My name is Luke. So glad you could be here today. Well, what I'm going to go ahead and tell you guys is we have an interview with the president of Zombie Incorporated. They are makers of a lot of games. Most notably right now is the Special Op games, and they also did a couple of maps for America's Army. So what we're going to do is we'll go ahead and we'll get into the interview. I didn't do a very good job of interviewing myself, but he did a really good job of speaking about what he does. So I apologize for my end. So let's go ahead and let's get into our interview, and we'll come on back afterwards. Okay, well, thank you for coming on the show again.
Certainly. Glad to help you out, Luke.
Okay, so my first question is, what was your first favorite video game?
Well, my very first video game was way back on the old teletypes. My dad was able to get me in on some of the campuses, and I was able to play Trek on the old teletypes, where it literally spit out a new piece of paper for every move you would make. But my first real game that I bought and then played to excess would have to be the original Civilization. I run it at 320 by 200 in CGA. I played that far, far too often.
So why did you get into the gaming industry?
Well, I'd always been dancing around the edges of the gaming industry, but never went into it full-time for a while. I was doing a lot of research into how we perceive computer space. I've got a couple degrees in experimental psychology, and that was back whenever drawing just a couple of polygons was a very big, expensive ordeal, and so people were looking for ways to maximize each poly or each pixel as far as conveying the most amount of information possible. And so I did a lot of virtual reality work way back in the day when that was going to change the world and we were all going to have chips implanted in our head. But of course, that didn't really quite pan out. My argument has always been basically because nobody could ever think of, you know, the equivalent of a VisiCalc or a electric pencil for, you know, the killer app that you need to really justify why you should put on a head-mounted display and a pair of gloves. So then I did some work for the Air Force. They actually paid for one of my graduate degrees, and looking at virtual reality to help train Air Force personnel to actually repair fighter jets, which was a little bit different from the normal use of VR, which was to train pilots to fly a little bit better. And then I also did a little bit of VR stereoscopic 3D research into how to use computer graphics at some nuclear reactors, and then I went off to the University of Washington at the Human Interface Technology Lab, the HIT Lab, run by Tom Furness, who did a lot of the super cockpit stuff back in the early 80s. And then from there, I went and joined a virtual reality company, Virtual I.O., that was making a head-mounted display. And at that time, there were probably four companies that were making head-mounted displays, V-Rex and Virtual I.O. and Victor Max, being among three of the bigger ones. But again, even though we had 90-some-odd titles that supported the Virtual I.O. headset, we just never were able to get that critical mass. But I do have fond memories of playing MechWarrior with a Virtual I.O. headset and the Thrustmaster rudder pedals and the Thrustmaster joystick and the Thrustmaster throttle. That was quite the experience. And then because my job at Virtual I.O. was going around and meeting all the developers and trying to get them to support our hardware, I was able to meet a lot of developers, and I decided that being actually in the development rather than supporting it was definitely a lot more fun. So I got a job at Zombie working on one of the games that we did that had a lot of military connections, and then I've been here ever since.
So now you are the president of Zombie right now, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So what are kind of the things that Zombie does?
Zombie has done a wide array of games. We've done everything from handheld games to multiplayer games to games that have been distributed on Real.com or Wild Tangent, one of which was the downloadable version of EA's SSX Tricky. We've also done a Build Your Own Roller Coaster ride for Disney. That was actually a lot of fun. You could go in to a touchscreen display and pick the type of world you wanted to be in, a space world, an underwater world, a fire world, and then pick the type of track that you wanted to have in there, and then go and get in the motion simulator. It would actually spin you upside down and jump you and go all kinds of crazy stuff. And then we've done a couple of kids' titles. We did Disney's game for Disney's movie Atlantis, and then we have also done primarily, though, a lot of military first-person shooters. Most recently, some of the work for the latest release of America's Army. We did two maps on that, and we also did the Spec Ops franchise, which is still Take-Two's number 3 selling franchise of all time. We've also done one of the Rainbow Six games and one of the Nova Logic Delta Force games.
So you guys mostly specialize in first-person shooter games.
Yes, that is definitely what we tend to get the most work doing.
So how did you guys get into that kind of area?
Mark Long and Joanna Alexander, who founded the company, first got us down in that path, because Mark Long is a former Army Ranger, and the Spec Ops franchise is how we initially got started. And then since then, we just have had continual success working on additional ones. Each one kind of gives us more experience in the field, and both as far as, you know, what that type of game should be, what the gameplay should be, as well as access to the type of the military technology all behind it. And so it just kind of feeds on itself. We have definitely done a few more esoteric things, everything from the roller coaster ride I mentioned to an award-winning video that we did for KMFDM, we did the original design work on the Brady Bunch Kung Fu for the cell phones.
Yeah, you guys, I'd like to kind of go back to that Special Ops game that you've been working on. Could you give me a little bit more information about that?
Well, the Spec Ops games was one of the ones that we did quite a while ago, and that one was a combination third-person, first-person game. It was out on the PlayStation, as well as the PC and the Dreamcast, and we did a sequel for, I think they ended up doing 3 sequels for the PlayStation and 2 for the PC. And it's very similar in its gameplay to the SOCOM games that are out these days.
What kind of research do you do for those kind of first-person shooter games?
Well, we try to spend as much time as possible out in the field. For Shadow Ops, which was a game that we did last year, and actually was the first ever 64-bit retail game. It came out on the Xbox as well. We actually traveled around the world to gather the source art for that, as well as get some ideas for some level designs. So I got to spend February in Moscow at their Space Center, which is very interesting. It's actually the coldest I've ever been. There's definitely a reason why Hitler and Napoleon couldn't defeat Russia in the middle of winter. It's cold. I've been on the top of Mount Rainier and a couple other mountains, and I've never been as cold as in Moscow in February. And then some other people got to go to Paris to photograph the streets and sewers of Paris, and some other people got to go to Syria to photograph some of the desert buildings and terrain and texture maps there. So we definitely traveled around quite a bit. We go to Fort Lewis at least once a year to blow stuff up and see how things are done. I've been out with several of the local SWAT teams to gather information on their tactics and animations. And if there's a weapon that you can legally fire, odds are I've shot it or blown something up with it. It definitely is one of the more interesting parts of the game.
And so mostly the game, you're trying mostly to show off a kind of, from the reviews I've been seeing, it's mostly you're trying to show off a pretty basic storyline. What kind of storylines are you guys trying to show off in your games?
Well, there was a recent article a couple of weeks ago that talked about that and why the appeal of FPS, the first-person shooter genre, is. And it's essentially the fact that the core gameplay mechanic you know, transcends the individual titles. It's something that people can pick up and understand. They don't need to spend 10 hours learning how to handle the driving of it and what the handbrake does that changes from game to game. It's first-person shooter is a first-person shooter. And the storylines, while there is a lot more attention being paid to storylines these days and a lot of Hollywood talent being hired to help out with them, it is always a TCR requirement that you can skip any of the non-interactive ones. So I always feel that should be pointed out, because that's why people play games versus watch a movie, is that the interactive part of it. And so the story should be enough to get you going, but this definitely doesn't need to be the end-all, be-all to the situation. That said, for Red Mercury, we picked what we thought was an interesting plot device, which is Red Mercury. And if you do a quick Google search on Red Mercury, you'll see that it's kind of the Loch Ness monster of the weapons of mass destruction. There's enough evidence out there that people have felt that it is real, and people have literally lost their lives trying to acquire it. And governments, both the U.S. and the Soviet Union, have spent millions of dollars trying to track down Red Mercury or disprove it. And so we picked that one because it's kind of this nebulous evil thing that nobody quite knows what it is, but there's enough of a buzz. But the reason why I picked the Red Mercury is it's nebulous and there's enough of a buzz about it that people can do a little bit of research and pick up on it itself. So that's why we picked that one. For the current project we're working on, which I can't discuss, that one has a whole backlog of story and plot line that will easily take care of all those issues.
And that's going to be another Spec Ops game again?
It'll be another military first-person shooter, yes.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I don't want to go away. I don't want to have to break any NDSs or anything like that. Do you think it's kind of, there's a lot of first-person shooters in your area, and do you think it's pretty hard to actually break out?
No, there are a lot of first-person shooters, no doubt, but they all tend to sell pretty well. Publishers like them because it's less risky than trying to do something more crazy with a cute mascot and a, you know, crazy bouncy world. And the people that buy them tend to buy quite a few of them. And since the vocabulary for the genre has been so well established, usually you don't need to try to reinvent it from scratch because you're usually not going to do well. But if you incrementally improve on one or two things, the fan base definitely seems to get behind you and appreciate that fact.
Have you found a lot of things that gamers have told you that just don't work, that you're continually trying to work upon, like, for example, escort missions?
Yeah, escort missions are always they always seem like a great idea when you first design them, but there definitely are troublesome, and definitely the feedback you get from the community is that people don't like escort missions. The multiplayer is always interesting, and the way I try to explain it internally while we're playtesting and balancing the weapons is that if we all get into a huge heated debate over the fact that this weapon is too good and that weapon versus that weapon is too good, then that means we've nailed it perfectly. If everybody agrees, oh, the sniper weapon's perfect, then that usually means that it's probably too powerful. But if we get half the people saying it's too powerful and half the people saying it's not powerful enough, then that usually means we've nailed it.
So also, you guys have been doing the Spec Ops, and you've been also doing some cell phone games and some other games for Wild Tangent. You guys are also working with America's Army. How did you guys get into working with the Army on making some maps for them?
Well, since we do primarily realistic military shooters, and we've done quite a few Unreal-based titles, there's very few companies that fit into that category. And so the America's Army group was out looking for some additional manpower to put towards a couple of the programs they were working on, and we happened to fit the bill perfectly. So we've done quite a few things with them. The publicly available maps is just a small part of what we've done, but we've also used the America's Army game engine to do some prototypes for some training programs, and this includes everything from a convoy engagement trainer that actually supports up to 8 screens for a full 360-degree wraparound, and you can network up to 16 of those pods together. to then reenact a convoy, because what you want to train troops is that if you're the first vehicle in a convoy and you get hit, your response is different than if you're the third vehicle and the fourth vehicle gets hit. We've got another one that helps teach new recruits how to read a map and use a compass and a protractor, because that's a skill that most people aren't familiar with. And so then you play the game and you're dropped out in the woods and you need to, you know, look at a map and see based on the geography where you are on that map and then find your way to the next waypoint. And let's see. And then, yeah, those are probably the two of the biggest ones we've done. We're probably going to do another one that will help out with some UAV familiarization for some of the troops. And then we've also done another one that wasn't for America's Army, but it's military related, for the Future Combat Systems Program, which Boeing here in Seattle is the lead contractor on. But what we did was we used the Empire Earth 3 engine to create a game that familiarizes people with what these weapon systems will be like that won't be released until 2012, 2014. So we essentially flipped the standard RTS upside down a little bit, because normally in a modern RTS you see the whole world in 3D space and you have a little small 2D map that just kind of shows you what you're looking at. But in our game we flipped that, because in the real world you can only see the 3D space through little sensor windows, and the 2D map is of course your main interface.
So how does it feel to be working here in the Seattle area?
Seattle is great. Seattle's the only place I've ever moved back to on purpose. My dad was in the Army, and I've traveled all over, and I just love it up here. The climate's perfect. There's mountains to go climbing in. There's water to go kayaking in. It's just perfect. And for a developer, it's great, because outside of L.A., this is the second highest concentration of game developers, so it's great. And the UW has a games program now, and DigiPen, and the Art Institute of Seattle, and a couple other schools, I think Cogswell as well, all have programs designed to help people get into the games business.
Yeah, you have to remember the school, the Edmonds Community College. We actually got a grant too. So yeah, we got a grant for gaming mathematics. So we're going to actually start some. So that'll be pretty cool.
Oh yes, perfect. I mean, we're definitely getting a lot of support here in this area, and it's great because it just, you know, feeds on itself. And of course, you've got Microsoft and Nintendo and, you know, Valve and Bungie and FASA, or what's left of them, are all up here. And, you know, then there's probably another two dozen other studios. So it's just a great place to be without being in L.A., which, you know, gives it another big plus.
So the Game Developers Conference is coming up soon. Are you going to be attending that?
Yeah, so I'll be attending, and I'll also be doing a little speaker bit on the Future Combat System game that I was discussing earlier.
What are you most excited about Game Developers Conference that you're going to be able to see?
To be honest, probably the most exciting thing is always just meeting more publishers and seeing what their needs are in the coming cycle. So other than that, I probably have seen everything else that I've currently heard about that is going to be at GDC. But it's always exciting just to see what publishers are up to and what they think is going to be selling well, and changes that they've made, and then how they're going to adjust. You know, for example, for a while, every publisher was coming out with a new urban crime type game, but those haven't sold very well over this last year. And I saw a couple of them just got canceled, and so it looks like a couple of people are going to be retooling, trying to pick what the next hot fad is going to be.
Do you think it's always a continual struggle with developers to find the right kind of genre that people would be interested in?
That is always a problem. Since we're an independent developer, ours is a little bit different in the fact that we rely on the publisher to do the lion's share of the funding for the development. So we are, you know, trying to fill their needs, and they're trying to fill usually their stockholders' expectations as far as what games are going to sell well. And it always seems like just when I'm getting tired of there being so many licensed properties and so many sequels, just like a lot of people, then there's, you know, a new franchise that comes out of nowhere that's a lot of fun to play, and that helps reinvent the industry for a while.
So what are your impressions about the next generation systems, the Xbox 360, the PS3, and the Revolution?
The Revolution definitely looks interesting because they've kind of have you know essentially said, well, we're not going to try to go after the big HD market that the other guys are going after. We're going to focus more on gameplay. And that definitely is an interesting way to go. People are saying that the casual game market is going to grow substantially. On the other hand, you know, do you really think you're going to be able to convince your mom to buy a Revolution? You know, is the gaming populace, you know, essentially like the people that watch NFL? It's kind of set. It's not going to get much bigger. So that'd be an interesting thing to see. It's definitely is interesting. They're definitely going to open it up because the cost of the dev kits is going to open it up to quite a bit more people. Now, the flip side of that, though, is that if it's opened up to too many people, then the public oftentimes just has a hard time determining, you know, what is good and what isn't. The cell phone industry always points out that unless you're in the top 10 or 20 on the list of games you can buy, no matter how good the game is or how good the reviews are, nobody ever picks it up because navigating through that space is so difficult. So I'd be curious to see if that's what happens. Same thing with the 360 Arcade. Now that they're moving from games that were built for the 360 Arcade into ports of some of the games that have been around a while longer, you know, if they fill up all those slots on the navigation menu, you know, is there going to be the possibility of another breakout hit like Geometry Wars, or will the experience be spread out over so many games like Paperboy and Gauntlet and things like that? The other big issue, of course, is the HDTV. It's interesting the fact that the games might actually be the ones pushing people to buy more HDTVs than the movie content. But both the PS3 and the Xbox 360 are both very powerful boxes, and no matter which one you get, I definitely think people will be satisfied with the experience.
Have you had a chance to see the Revolution or try out? Because it seemed like they said that you could do a first-person shooter with it, with the controller. And I was wondering, are you guys thinking about how that could work with first-person shooters in your market, or?
I haven't tried the Revolution. I've just seen whatever is available on the web. It definitely looks like you could do a first-person shooter with it, no problem. You could probably even have some very innovative ways to interact with it. Just worried that if you're too innovative with it, you might suffer from fatigue pretty quickly with your hand. But it definitely could be interesting in parts. You know, sort of like the little mini games they have in the last Resident Evil. So it definitely opens it up to a lot more interesting stuff. And the fact that it's shaped like a TV controller, that might be the way that gets your mom to play it. But on the other hand, you know, your mom hasn't played a game in 40 odd years. Is she really going to play another one now?
Well, what is next for Zombie?
Well, unfortunately, I can't tell you. We're working on some next-gen stuff, and it's looking very exciting and very interesting. And unfortunately, that's all I can say at the moment.
Is it going to be next year? Or is that no?
Let's see. Yeah, definitely be next year, yeah.
So sometime next year, we should be seeing some really good first-person shooter from Zombie.
Yes. Yeah, we'll have a couple other things out before then, but some of the bigger projects we're working on won't be out until next year.
So what kind of advice would you give to people who are thinking about becoming game developers?
One thing I always recommend is, you know, keep track of what's going on all the blogs and web pages are out there, and get together with some people and do a mod. The engines now and the tools that you have are not very much different from the engines and tools that we use. You know, the Unreal Engine or the Source Engine, you know, they have the editor and all the tools you need to get going. A great demo of a mod that you've made goes a long way.
So do you think that the Unreal mod is actually the best mod to be practicing for people who are starting into the gaming industry?
The Valve Source Engine has some advantages, no doubt. But the biggest advantage of going with the Unreal is the fact that a lot more developers are using that engine. So that definitely gives it a big plus, I think. And the both the Source and the Unreal Engine both have a pretty big web support base as far as helping you out with tutorials or a couple of lessons and, you know, how to import and export files and all that. So either one is a good one to do. The Doom 3 engine also is still pretty good, but not as many people game-wise are using that engine as used to be. If you wanted to go for an engine that you wanted to learn, most likely your potential employer is going to have, it's going to be the Unreal Engine. But that I would go with whichever one you can pick up the fastest and have access to or that your friends know.
All right. Well, thank you for coming on the show, and hopefully we'll be able to talk again soon. And that was my interview with him. He was really great. I hope to get another interview with another special person in the Seattle area. But if you have any comments, questions, or have anything else you want to talk about gaming-wise, email me at gameacthotline@gmail.com. Remember, this podcast is at www.gameaddicthotline.com, and you can subscribe to it through Yahoo Podcasts. You can become a friend with us at Podcast Pickle or vote for us at Podcast Alley. Well, that's going to be it for today. I hope to see you guys Saturday for another episode of the Game Addict Hotline.